Swashbuckler Epiphany Episode 6. No weasels were harmed during the recording of this podcast.
Swashbuckler Epiphany. Epiphany. Swashbuckler.
Testing. Can you hear me, mother?
I thought you were going to do the testicles joke again. I wasn't.
I meant to go, Peace Haven calling. I'm going to do that on my radio. I've got another radio show now. Campbell Road Studio Radio for Jamie Bilbao.
Yeah.
He's already played my 2-hour punk reggae special, actually. It's a good listen. I don't know if he's got a catch up yet. He seems to be.
He's learning as he goes along. Yeah,
he was broadcasting
because I picked up on that on Facebook. There was a link or something. It was him having a conversation that probably wasn't actually intentionally kind of public. and I thought I'll have a little look at that. And it was broadcasting something, but I don't know what it was.
Well, you'd have known if it was me.
Yeah, because it did sound a bit like your music choice, to be fair.
Yeah, I played a fair bit of. I played a load. I got this. I've got a huge collection of punk and reggae. Ho ho. And you can find everything now, can't you, off YouTube? Yeah. Both the stations I'm doing now are fully licensed, so
you could
rip with impunity and play them.
I was gonna bring that up with you because I was listening to your Jacko Eclectica, and I was thinking, yeah, he's playing like loads of like legit music. This must be legit because you're not really, you know, even though
there's a broadcasting like package that that builds it in, builds the license in, you know. Mm. I can't remember what it's called now, and I'd have to go tinkering about online, and I'd rather not risk it. Who knows what might happen?
Yeah,
I was just trying to work out if we this is the first swash since my op.
Yes, it is. I was going to say when was the last time we spoke, and it was quite because of the subject matter what we talked about. It must have been quite close after Johnny's funeral or something.
Yeah, I think it was. It was. Yeah,
so
it was
post heart attack.
February, maybe, or something, that sort of time.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, it was post heart. I mean,
post,
I waited
post heart attack and because you spoke about that quite extensively.
Yeah, What about shiting myself about the?
Yeah, and then there was that long, protracted period when you were waiting for the op. And
yeah, let's have a rant about the quick rant about the NHS as a moral imperative. Mm. I waited from September till March.
Yeah,
for the op, but the operation. I'll tell the story quick, shall I? Might as well catch the listener up.
Yeah,
it was nothing to fear. Anyone who's waiting for a stent, but I thought it was a stent.
Yeah,
and it ended up being four and a vessel drilled. That sounds great, doesn't it? Yeah. Four and drill. But if that hadn't have worked, if that drilling and hadn't worked, the next one's opening heart. So
yeah.
I got to wait. But you're awake for a couple of things that are really important, I think, other than my own feelings and thoughts about it. I suppose the amusing side of it was they gave me the relaxing drugs and I did quite a lot of singing and talked all the way through it to the surgeon. I asked him if he minded and he went, no, it's quite unusual, but no. So I was watching this wire go up my artery into my heart on the screen. Whilst talking to him about Noah Harara and Kurt Vonnegut and stuff, interspersed with when he said, this next bit can hurt, so we're going to give you some more drugs.
Yeah.
And I sang Jim Morrison's, I sang Changeling during the hurty bit. So I'm literally, no exaggeration or mythologizing at all. I'm literally lying on the operating table going, I live uptown.
The trouble is, though, Brent, you don't need a lot of encouragement to burst into song or drop a poem or two.
Yeah, exactly.
Give you a drink and it's even more likely. If you dope you up for an operation, it's a racing certainty, isn't it?
I said to the, it was funny because, as I think I might have mentioned, the team that did the exploration, nobody to this day knows why they didn't just do it while they're in there. But the team at the operation were dreadful. Yeah. You know, there was a guy there tapping on me testicles like he thought they were congas, and I could feel everything, and it was horrible. And they didn't, you know, they were annoyed. And this one was the exact opposite. Mm. The whole team were great, and it was funny, and it was warm, and you know, and I did. I did obviously go into a bit of distended, druggy ramble, but they really enjoyed it. There was a lot of laughter. And they were clearly quite surprised that anybody was that gregarious. You know, they'd met gregarious people before, and people, you know, manning up and stiff upper lipping it one. But I don't think they'd ever met anything quite like that. I said to him, yeah, I like to kid myself. I'm a legend in my own time. You know, he went, I don't think you're kidding yourself. We'll be talking, as you know, when they finished, we'll be talking about this for some time. But I got on really well with the surgeon, you know, and he was telling me about this guy who invented the stent. Mm. I mean, there's a fella. He saved X amount of people's lives. Yeah. I mean, small inflatable tunnels that go in the fucking heart, you know. Hello? And he was, you know, he was also saying that it's becoming almost received wisdom now in the medical profession. That, you know, all this sort of railing against fat people and smokers and the rest of it is sort of going out the window. It's genes, you know, that we Celts, you got the old Geordie and Irish and you know, as I have, we have this gene where our hearts clog up at 50 plus. I mean, in Scotland and Ireland, it's many, well, throughout history, it's been a huge killer. Mm. And this Celt medical genius has got round. But we were also talking about, he was a really interesting fellow. As I say, he's currently reading Sapiens, you know, the Noah Harari book.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, I've just read Homo Deus, you know, the follow-up. And he talks a lot in that about how, you know, we've more people die now from obesity than starvation.
Yeah.
We've kind of, apart from some serious distribution problems, we've kind of conquered hunger. We've wiped out in our lifetime, Phil, quite a few diseases. Mm. And the aim is immortality, and we'll get there.
Yeah.
And the way we'll get there is, of course, nanotechnology, little robots keeping you going in your body, going around keeping you 35 forever, however anyone feels about that. You know, and if you get a bit fucking jaded, you'd better go and have a kip for 100 years or something. And he, a surgeon, was saying, oh, yeah, absolutely. We're not that far off that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
And we've had this on a swash before, I'm sure of it, you know, this thing. All that stuff in the mythology, we then went and invented, you know.
Yeah.
Flight, well,
it's always the way, isn't it? Fiction drives invention, you know. It's like, you know, every kid who watched Star Trek and thought, you know, fast and light travel and little communicators that you flip open and you can talk to anyone in the world.
And it seemed like that was our great-grandchildren might see most of that.
Yeah.
And, of course, we have seen most of it.
Yeah.
A little device that Bones used to, and Spot used to have, like little laptops or iPads on the planet. And there's so much of it, isn't there?
Yeah.
The little earpieces, all of it. Yeah. I mean, it's just... And we dream, don't we? First you dream it, then you build it. Mm. And that's the human way, almost, you know.
Yeah.
And we, you know, in our mythology, there were a race of people who live forever, you know, and omniscient and omnipresent. I mean, telepathy. Yeah. What are fucking mobile phones, really? Mechanical telepathy. You can talk to a guy in Australia, you know. We could bring a guy in on this conversation in Australia. Let's say, you know, Coop or someone was in Australia. He could join this conversation very easily.
Yeah, and peculiarly, almost in real time as well. Because because you know, I've had conversations. I have conversations with Matt over in Florida, quite frequently, and well, once a week actually. We scheduled because we realised that we just didn't do it.
Yeah,
and as is evidenced by the fact there was so long between swashes.
Which Matt?
we really ought to schedule at least one a month or something.
Yeah, there's so many Matts. Which one?
Matt Kelland.
Oh, Kelland. Yeah. Okay.
He's the one who used to live local to me in Froome, and then he met some American girl and went out to America.
Yeah,
and he actually lived in Florida and met up with Johnny and Damon a few times because they used to live out there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I spoke to John out there quite a fair bit.
Yeah, and the thing is, the communication between here and there is astonishing. Really, I mean, we used to phone people up, didn't you, on a telephone, and there used to be like 10-15 second delay, so you'd talk and then you'd have to wait for them to get it and then talk back,
so much that was unthinkable 100 years ago is now day to day, and so you extrapolate out because it speeds up, also as we communication, especially frighteningly. I'm not so convinced though that it's necessarily feeding an education improvement. Not with this swing to the right and Trump and Farage, and I mean, how can they say he's going to clean up at the Euros? I mean, I just don't get it.
It doesn't make any sense, does it? It really doesn't
it
make
really
any sense.
It really doesn't. I mean, he's a proved liar.
So it sort of makes no sense, but it also sort of makes perfect sense.
She needs. Later you'll be waiting down on your knees. She's dancing with the Wu-Tang. Dancing with the Wu-Tang. Dancing with the Wu-Tang. We'll be right back.
things I'm thinking, a lot of the reasons that I'm writing this book, for starters, is to do with the pondering things about human consciousness that feed into things like that. Like, why do we make all these bad choices? Why do people repeatedly choose bad partners, you know, of the same sort? You know, why do people elect to stay with someone who's obviously a wrong'un?
I think I don't think there's a catch-all answer, Phil.
No, there isn't. There's many answers.
My bad choices were driven by the rather bland and obvious Freudian thing of I was attracted to women like my mum, who were a bit mad-eyed, drunken, dancey types, you know. And I really was. And it took me 4 long-term hair-raising relationships.
White-knuckle relationships.
Yeah, to actually, work it out, identify it. And still, after I'd identified it and had the therapy studied it and looked at it, I still had to go easy. The pulsion was still in there, but bone deep, as it were.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think everybody ever even always finds out why, you know. But in my case, it was pretty fucking clear that as icky as it is, and also, to be honest with you, revealing, we do get our idea of the opposite sex from our mother as our daughters get it from us, from fathers. And I've really paid for that because obviously I was a wild and crazy and spontaneous and alpha sort of bloke.
Yeah.
And I have to put up with son-in-laws who are like me. And that's another one of life's rich and depressing lessons.
Yeah. It is there is a kind of an underlying principle, especially the interpersonal stuff is quite varied, but the sort of international stuff, the voting problem, is to do with I think we talked about this last time. I have this theory about how our consciousness is being eroded, the very technology that we were just talking about is making it difficult for people to sort of connect with their own consciousness. They're kind of living outside their heads in this kind of devil's advocate world of theoretical scenarios.
Well, it does tie into my son-in-laws because there's a sort of causal learning loop going on, almost karmic, But there's also that I think that our connectedness has been eroded a bit too, because so much of it is intimacy and body language based and so on. Because we're monkeys, you know. And
so it's all intellectual, it's not physical anymore.
Yeah, that's right. And the loss of that is going to be ruinous, I think. I think so.
Yeah, I believe so.
I'm sure. I'm sure of it, And there'll have to be a reversal in some way.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, that's what actually, that's actually the subject of my book. I mentioned darkly this war that happened, basically not to spoil it for anyone who reads it, I'm kidding myself. Anyone other than my circle of friends are going to read it. And actually, I'm only writing it for my circle of friends, that's my strategy. But I'm not writing it for a demographic.
It's a good subject. Yeah, Phil, I don't want to put you off the rails because I do want to discuss what you're working on at length. But I tell you, it's absolute death of any project to start wondering who'll like it. I did say this to Izzy the other night. I wrote a couple of poems for a festival I'm appearing in. As usual, my vomiting's coming, puking, coughing it up sort of stuff, me, I'm a big serious editor. No, my best stuff does just come in bursts like that. And I did say, I've realised it more the older I've got, which is that we think at one stage, I think, as creatives, that we were actually wanting people to go, oh, well done, look at you, aren't you clever? That's what we think superficially we do it for, but we do it for ourselves.
Yeah.
Do it to
It takes you a long time to realise that in our case.
It does. It's a
it's
long
time. It's like decades and decades of
younger artists
pandering.
Yeah, because, the stuff where artists pandered dreadfully, they always end up not wanting to go back to it, like it's dog vomit, don't they? They always, it's always always embarrassing stuff. And the great, and I mean great, and often not even recognising their time, but the really great artist completely abandoned that. And I think like Van Gogh, Scott Walker, there are a number. Philip K. Dick, you could argue. They just did what they wanted to do in their own frenzy of solipsistic, you know, creativity. And that's the way to be. That's the way to work. You know, you've panders is another thing.
It's like you might have a desire to write something. Like every creative has this kind of non-specific desire to write, you know, a book like their heroes or something, or write a book that's successful. And that's that's one thing. But there's it's another thing to have to be writing a book that you. Or writing a song, or writing a poem, or painting a picture that really sets your pants on fire, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, did we all enjoy ourselves, and was it comforting and so on? And yes, everybody was momentarily taken out of their existential fear. But did anybody learn anything?
Yeah.
You or the audience learned.
I think first you, then, then the audience.
Let's try and hone it down to the art that involves and the art that evolves.
Yeah.
I think that's the division, isn't it?
Yeah.
It might be.
Yeah.
I really do. And I think that some of the work I do, I think that I've grown a bit there.
Mm.
You immediately think, that's gone somewhere new. I don't want to say forward or back or up or down, because that's... Yeah. It's more than that without being pretentious.
I think prejudging the direction it's going, up or down, is one of those
expansion.
Things you have to avoid.
And also, exactly. A bit boring and parallel and classical anyway. And I mean, it's expansion. Mm. But it's that thing of, I learned something there about me and others and so on. And it's great when you realise that you're doing it.
Yeah.
For that, primarily.
Doing the book is the kind of strategy, because I'm holding on to, is normally what you do when you write a story is you plan it, you plot it, and you plan it all out, and you spend so much time researching and planning it that all the juice goes out of it.
The jams are better than the rehearsed songs, isn't it? I'm getting together with the Fire Dogs on Friday, and what happens is we try a load of numbers where we know the structure roughly, and we think, we should have recorded that song and this song, and we know them songs. Mm. And we'll inevitably have two or three jams that absolutely wipe the floor with all that stuff. You know? And it's the same thing as you're talking about with what you're writing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Get the fucking trainer wheels off.
Yeah.
You know? Get the preconceptions fucking out of the way.
Yeah.
And just I'm glad in a way, because you've got you puke it forth. and then don't become mannered and self-conscious and fucking pander.
Yeah, it is, and it's actually become an exercise in actively avoiding every kind of planning. You know, whatever.
That'll be good therapy for you.
Exactly.
And spoiler, I know you quite well, just exactly what you need a bit more of, isn't it?
Exactly, it's like jazz, but not. Not that, well-practiced sort of gesture jazz. Mm. It's the jazz where you've been doing tunes for decades, and you can play, you can just sit and play all day and not repeat yourself, and it's
more
that.
Feeling than thought, the perfect.
Yeah, exactly. You're sort of dancing a line between it going off the rails completely and going into a pat format. And maintaining that line is exquisite and entertaining and educational.
And you don't want to get stuck in notions. I mean, I remember having an afternoon of something I read had got me going on it, I think, or heard. But everything's an algorithm, everything from love to the buses running. It's all an algorithm. And I think after about 2 hours, I'm bored of this now. You don't want to get stuck in a notion,
Because
there are no absolute truths other than change, as we've already said before.
Yeah.
I'd like it if I was shallow. Pouting and tears. I'd like it if I was shallow. The camera angles are weird. I'd like it if I was shallow. Violence and killing is cool. I'd like it if I was shallow. A death a minute is a rule. I'd like it if I was shallow. Her clothes are quirky and fun.
Yes.
I'd like it if I was shallow. The hero was carrying a gun.
Oh no!
I'd like it if I was shallow. Lying and cheating as lifestyles. I'd like it if I was shallow. Even children have calculating smiles. I'd like it. If I was shallow. Is there a subtext? Is there a subtext? Tears.
I'll tell a story about that again, quick, just quickly, about the, a blind Jewish philosopher I used to read to. via Steph's mum. I used to go around there and read to him. And he read, he was interested in really fascinating stuff. And you know me, I'm semi-literate in a way. He was the one who told me it's not hyperbole. You know, he said hyperbole. Oh, hyperbole. And he enjoyed it. Like, but I read to him, and he used to always, many times, say to me, "Oh, there are no absolute truths." I mean, he's probably one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. You know, clever and very open and liberal as well. Not some of the very clever people you meet are quite uptight, aren't they? Quite sort of set.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't.
They get absorbed by their intellectualism, which is kind of what we were talking about with the technology taking away people's consciousness.
But I think this is also does tie into the way you're writing now, and what has been a kind of element of our style, yours, mine, you know, the people that we would like to work with, of that random, we want a large anything might fucking happen bollocks to the rules element in play, because all the stuff we really love had that, you know.
Yeah.
The stuff we really still love has that, you know, edge of Roxy and even the Beatles, actually. You don't know what will happen next because they're not really following the usual rule book.
Yeah.
David Lynch and on. And anyway, he said to me, there's no absolute truth. And I thought, well, that sounds spot on, you know.
Mm.
And then I worked out that though it's dichotomous, contradictory, I worked out there is one, and that's change.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked it out from a very simple simple sum, really. The universe is expanding and rotating, you know. So everything's moving, spinning and moving on.
Yeah.
So I did go back to him the last time I saw him, actually, and said, I think I found an absolute truth. And he said, no, you haven't. I said, I think I have. He went, well, go on. I went, change. And he went very quiet for a while. And then he did. I gave me one of the only plaudits I've ever had that mattered to me, which was, you, sir, are an original thinker. Which, coming from a thinker of his statue at the time, you can imagine around with a six foot full glandular stick, you know. But it's true. The only absolute truth is change. And that contradiction in that as well is important. It's telling, you know. The algorithms are counterintuitive.
It is. It's a really weird. It's been very educational because it's one of those things you realise it's not an exercise in getting out loads of ideas. It's an exercise in balancing on that point where that happens. You know, and I just I realise the things I love most about writing, and I've been trying to write some sort of meaningful fiction for decades, you know. And been
you
working
care
as
too
a
much, you see. That's what? The problem is you are a specialist and you've really gone in there and you know you soaked in all the Philip K. Dick and the writers that you Fleming and others, and there are many others I know, but I won't just leave it there. I will just leave it there. But you soak them in bone deep, you know. And you care too much, you know. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you're going along, and it's going to become mannered if you think, oh, is that too Fleming? Oh, is that too Dick? Vonnegut? Is that too Heinlein? Is that too, you know, and on, Steinbeck, whatever, you know. Yeah. And I'm lucky because being a bit of a sort of idiot savant, I don't do that. I can't create and do that at the same time.
Yeah.
Because I think there's something in my mind that's off a wandering in the sky, Lord, you know, when I create. I mean, that Fit In or Fuck Off, which was the best sort of best gusher I've had for a long time. You know? It just I got up at like 2:30 with a bit of a chest pain, and I thought, I went down and I was standing in the kitchen in my boxes, you know, boiling the kettle.
Yeah.
So I got up and have a cup of tea and a vape, you know.
Mm.
And it just came all in one flow, you know. And I thought, oh, great, that still happens then. And it just flowed. And it didn't, it's just a load of archetypes, you know, school refusers, drug abusers, you know, and so on.
Yeah.
But the rhymes just came like that without any thought or manner. And that's the only real way I write. I like working, you know, because I hear people, I've never related to this, and I know you do to some extent, but I've never related to these people who go, oh, I can never think what to draw.
Yeah.
I've never had that.
Yeah.
I've never sat down with a plan.
Yeah.
I have with writing poetry, because I'm often chanting them in my head as I run home from the bus, you know,
yeah.
or thinking of them in the bath and thinking, right, I've got to get out of this fucking bath now and write this down because now I've got up to 20 lines. I'm going to run out.
You've reached your buffer limit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. My buffer's full. And nobody wants to be in the bath with a full buffer. You know? And there's your title. There's your strap line. Oh, I just saw another couplet. Strap line, strap on.
Yeah.
it's the usual
thing. It's not so much ideas, it's writing them down fast enough.
They're the ones I like anyway. If they don't have come that way,
yeah,
then they're bollocks.
Yeah, I abandoned the whole kind of like strive, sort of working for an idea. You don't work for an idea, you know.
No, plan as you go.
You can employ a bit of craft and a bit of strategy after you've written it all down, you know. And you can sort of strategize and you can sort of formulate and pat it into shape like a butter, you know. The thing which came home to me, and it's, I don't know where all this came from, really. It all sort of came together at once. I realised that basically all the things that we've done to this, all the stuff we've absorbed to this point, it's like charging up the battery, and you basically just got to use it, you know, and you've got to allow the battery to deplete, you know, So it's all this time is like charging the battery. All this time is like getting ready to do this, you know. And if I'd have realised that sooner, I probably would have done it sooner. But I don't think I've really truly been ready, you know.
Well, nothing's a bigger millstone around a creative person's neck than the notions of the great work, you know.
Yeah.
Because I think there's an element in creative people and performers and so on where they've got, without getting into pretentiousness, they've got a feeling of kind of destiny, you know, a feeling like meant to do something, better look for it. And often, obviously, some of them will go into the arts. They'll also go into politics, engineering and whatever. And I think there's an element of that in it. But I also think it's a millstone. You know, you can't start thinking, oh, I'm 60 and I've done me great work yet.
Yeah.
Because you know what? You might have, you know, you might have and not even noticed.
Yeah.
You know? I've got a feeling I've left some bits behind that, I hardly even acknowledged I'd done, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that thing of you hear a quick demo you did, you know, 3 years ago and think, fuck me, that's great.
Yeah. And at the time,
you just forgot about it. Yeah. Wandered off.
Or barely considered it, but it actually turned out to be pretty good.
Plus, life's bloody distracting, Phil. You know,
it is a bit.
I've always said to you, you know, it's the lighthouse is the real answer if you're really hell bent on a great work. You know.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, I absolutely feel that. I mean, it's like this week when and the rare occasions that Jude goes away with her mum and sis. You know, I try to kind of focus on stuff like that. I try and focus on doing the work. And it's nice. I've actually got a book on the go so that I can sort of plough a bit of that energy into. And it's been great. Mm. But I find that because I know that it's only a week or, you know, a portion of a week, I don't get started on it nearly as much as I would if it was open-ended. You know?
Yeah.
If you add like...
You're doing it longhand, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah.
And that is, you've got all sorts of prestigious antecedents there, haven't you?
Yeah.
Because the only way so many were. I mean, Evelyn Waugh and P.G. Woodhouse immediately spring to mind. I believe J.G. Ballard as well.
Yeah, Conan Doyle, obviously,
They only did fountain pen.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but I think Fleming as well, actually.
I think Fleming used a typewriter, the most interesting one, Neil Gaiman, obviously. He abandoned the typewriter like 30 years ago.
Mm. There are many. And also, the majority of the answers, both, as usual. The answer's always both, isn't it?
Yeah.
the more I realised it was weird, actually, because I had this theory before. Well, certainly before I met Izzy, and it's probably come up in a swash earlier too. But this idea that the answer is always both, and it was almost like a premonition of cognitive dissonance. You know, I still like cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
I think it's got to be used for more than just an FB site, I think.
Yeah, I think that is. I saw that the other day, and I thought, yeah, there's something in there. There's something in there.
That's a thing, isn't it? I think it's probably the second fire dog.
It's got to be a thing. It's got to be like an album or a track or something.
And I know it's also just a small side track in the lighter territory, well, potentially lighter territory. I noticed that this work was forming itself, and it's that ranting Beasley Street type lyric and Andy and Ollie's Cheeky Spiders music.
Yeah.
Because I was sending, I was having the discipline to send them to Cooper.
Yeah.
And read them, you know, and then not. And leave lots of headroom and not put any effect on or you know, drum beat or whatever, and send it to him. And this work sort of it's just happened without anybody planning it really. And there's about six or seven of them now.
Yeah,
and they are like maximum lunacy. Really, they're more like the Loonies album than the Loonies album, really, in a way, because they're just me ranting in a but only the flows that really the flow that goes, you know.
Yeah.
And then getting dropped on their mad, 3 a.m. jams.
Yeah,
all that technology that they've collected.
Yeah,
and it's like a perfect storm. You know, drop a bit of fucking G on a nylon acoustic on there, and a little bit of a bit of Hawkwind style electric guitar. And you've got the full thing. Totally unplanned. You know, some of them are jams you had around for years. So I mean, you know, it does make you think, well, working methods?
Do we know anything about that? It's a thing where you get these periods where you desperately want to create something and you can't think of a way of doing it. And I think what the problem is you're looking for a new way of doing it, you know, rather than working with what you've got, you know.
Well, I got that Josh Brown who invited me to do the. I'm not deliberately harping on this, but it just came up in the flow there. He asked me to do two poems for the Portsmouth Poetry Festival, and he invited me down to read them, or he'd get an actor. Now, that caused a conflict because I said, "Oh, it'd be great to get an actor read." I'd love to hear, you know, as you once suggested, you need like an Anthony Hopkins to read these.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, oh man, I want to go down there and perform and film that and have that in the bank.
Yeah.
So, like the idea of having an actor reading it, you know. I really split. I want both.
It's a tricky one, isn't it?
And I don't want to sound like a right twat by going, look, can the actor read one and I'll read the other one? The answer's both, Josh, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want an actor or do you want to perform it?
I'll be leaning to actor, you know, just because it's such a fucking great buzz and so great to hear your own stuff done. You know, it's like when people cover a song. Oh man, it's happened to me a few times, but oh, it's so great.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
It's anything but brilliant.
Well, I mean, as you know, I've experienced people performing my words on a number of occasions, and when Damien got the school kids he was working with to do Maxine, and I actually got to go to a performance of Maxine. It was the first time I've ever been to a performance of.
Yeah, they're actually appearing in it.
And that was just.
The best thing ever, yeah.
That was just an out of body experience, you know. That
I went to see a mate's band back in the mid-90s.
And
unbeknownst to me, they were doing Looks from a Window off the Loonies' first single. When they went into it, I nearly cried, you know. It was like overwhelming. It was really good and went down great. I didn't know.
Yeah.
I didn't know they were even going to do it. And they really, really broke their neck to get me to go to this gig. And I'm really bad at going to mates' gigs, you know. I have no desire to see a mate struggle or be fat or fall on his arse, you know. And unless it's one of the real inner circle or big boys yourself, Kevin Bautista, Cooper Project or whatever, I'm really reluctant, you know.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to go along there and fucking throw myself about and pretend it's fab if it ain't and on and on.
Yeah.
But I went anyway, and there you go. He did Looks from a Window, and he did a really great job of it too. Yeah. And I just stood there thinking, wow. You know, I've made it now.
Yeah, but it's actually a slightly different art form, doing things for other people to do. I've always been a bit sort of hands on, and I've always wanted to sort of make films, but only if I can hold the camera. You know, always wanted to make films where I wrote it as well. So I wrote it, I work the camera, and I direct it, and. Mm. I probably do the special effects and the prosthetic makeup as well, you know.
Yeah, but if somebody asked you to appear in their films, let's say Mark Birch, said, look, I've got a part for you, I've looked at your phone online, I've got the sort of feeling of it, I just want you to come and play this character, you'd love that, wouldn't you?
Oh yeah, no, sure, for sure.
All that stuff, you know, and you'd be all the way up there going, like, don't get involved in the cameras, don't get involved in direction, just let him do his thing and just do the part. And by the way, have you watched Barry?
Yes.
Oh,
yes, good. I have.
That's good work.
It is good work.
Henry Winkler's. Oh, absolutely.
We just
joy
happened across it by accident, and it's a joy. It really is.
I'm surprised. It's so... you sure I didn't recommend it?
I don't know. You may have done.
Oh, I mentioned it on the Skype, you know, because Dave said it to me. He said, I'm compelling you to go and watch it and stick with it.
You may have said that, but as usual, I probably forgot.
Anyway. Are you following it?
Yeah, we are. We're sort of. It's one of them sort of go-to shows where we think, oh, have we got anything to watch? And we're like, no. I'm sure. Well, let's watch a couple of episodes of that then.
Yeah, I found another one last night. State of the Nation.
Oh yeah.
Who's got that? Chris O'Dowd in it.
Oh yeah.
You know, who's fabulous? Always. Yeah. I think he was in the It Crowd, wasn't he?
That's right.
Anyway, he's him and a woman whose name I've shamefully forgotten. And it's all set in the pub across the road from the marriage counsellors.
Yeah.
And it's their meet-ups before they go in there. But you don't actually go in. They don't actually go into the counselling. There's none of it's filmed in there. It's just them talking before they go in.
Yeah.
And each one of them's that. And it's superbly written. It really is. It's bordering on Fleabag quality. So I'll recommend that to you, State of the Nation. It's I think it's an iPlayer job. I've got a feeling it's a Beeb show.
All right. Oh, that's even better.
Yes, if you can't find it on iPlayer or Netflix, tell me and I'll get them for you because I've got the digitals. Mm. Oh, censor, edit. but it is, there's a little tip. Well, Barry is a cornucopia of wonders, isn't it?
It is. It's just one. As you pointed out, Henry Winkler is amazing.
He's a joy in it. Well, I'll tell you a little thing's interesting. What a signifier that it was superb was... in the first episode, I'm watching the first episode, and Barry's handler gets a chair and turns it round and goes to sit on it back to front, you know, as you do on chairs. The chair's got handles. He goes to put his leg over and then he looks. And at that moment, I thought, I like this writer.
Yeah.
You know, because he's seen that, hasn't he?
Yeah.
It's not something you think up, is it? That's something he's seen.
That's something you've done.
And put in his notebook, you know. And that was my sign that there was something going on.
Yeah, you knew it was a quality show. And, I mean, it's
from that moment.
It's got really, really good people in it.
Who's the male lead? Because I don't know him.
It's Bill Hader. I think he actually writes it as well.
Wow.
Yeah, I think he actually, it's his passion project. It's really there's lots of little moments like that, and like you, I saw that and I thought there was no need for them to put that in, but they put it in anyway, and it just made it a billion times better.
Yeah, the female lead is like every lovey ever, self-obsessed lovey ever.
I know.
Played really well.
It's perfection. That part and the show in general. You know, it's.
Are you up to date? I'm not going to say anything about it anyway.
I'm not sure. I think because how many seasons is there? Like three seasons?
No, two.
I'm on
episode. I think episode. I just watched Sundays. Because Monday is Game of Thrones Barry killing Eve day.
Yeah.
Monday's what Dave calls TV heaven, you know. He gets up Monday morning and by 7:30 he's watched Game of Thrones killing Eve and Barry, and it's all downhill from there. First, we should cover a bit of the old Game of Thrones, you know, just for the history books.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about when I was watching the episode. Spoilers alert, readers.
Yeah.
It'll all be over by
the time.
It'll
be over by the time anyone hears it.
Yeah, luckily. But what I was thinking about when I was watching the last season, episode 5, Penultimate, was I was thinking that we've become jaded by it because it's just so well done and good.
Yeah.
You know, dragons flying above a city, thermonuclear doom, you know. Yeah. It's just meh.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
we are, you know, and they're in a no-win situation now because they've upped the bar so much.
Yeah,
in terms of, you know, TV spectacle quality, twists, unexpected event. They just can't win now, can they?
No,
they're just never gonna.
I did think that exact thing because obviously I haven't been able to watch it yet because. Jude isn't able to watch it, so I've got to wait until she gets back, and then we're going to watch the last two back to back. So,
all right. Well, I won't say any more about it.
No, carry on because she won't hear it, and I already know what goes on.
Okay. Well, we're in a storm, aren't we? There's an internet storm because nobody wanted Dany, the mother of dragons,
to turn
into a bad Targaryen.
I saw that coming ages ago.
I thought there was two ways they'd go, you know, and one would be that she would not get what she's sought for the whole run because she's got a heart and falls in love and she chooses love over power and blah.
Yeah.
Or, as you say, the other alternative would be she'd go full on Targaryen and kill everybody or something.
And I think there's. I was reading something very interesting about that. It was saying that somebody, like a trader or something, when they were trying to get into that city where the guy had the vault, the big black guy had the vault, and they were talking to the merchants outside that, and he said something like, they had a little conversation. She basically turned up, wanted the earth and didn't want to pay for it. And he goes, and he said, so just your basic Targaryen then, you know. And I think that was that when somebody said, well, this is basically what that guy was kind of previewing is like, you know, she went into
a place called the Hall of Faces, and she had some visions in there. And there's one of her walking in the throne room at King's Landing, and it looks like snow. The roof's all gone and there's snow everywhere, and you think, oh, this is the this makes most people think the White Walkers will make it down that far and maybe devastate, and of course it's ash. And that was beautiful, but nobody appreciated that. And the other thing, of course, is that Cersei causes it all. She's actually who's to blame. And you could argue that Dany hasn't lost it. She's just realised this is the only way this fucking bitch and her legacy and everything that she's done will be cured. As much as it's horrible, her idea is I want to rid the world of tyrants, you know. Yeah. And this is the only way it's going to work. You know, there's no way. They already offered a softer solution, and she beheaded her bestie, didn't she, in front of in 4.
Yeah.
And I think there's an interesting sort of piece of human psychology at play here, Phil, because people don't want to face that.
Yeah.
They don't want to face the only way to get rid of this inutterably evil bitch is a more inutterably evil bitch comes along and removes her, you know. And there's a part of the human thing that, you know, there's a snowflake impetus in it, almost, you know, compulsion to say, what's the alternative, you know?
You sort of, they've sort of suckered you into wanting her to do it, you know, and also Jon Snow's always telling her to do it the right way, you know. And you, there's a bit of you that wants her to sort of get the job done, but in the right way, you know.
Yeah, well, Jon Snow wouldn't get the job done, would he?
Because no, he wouldn't. And that's going to be the point of the final episode, I think, is that, you know, she, but, you know, the thing is, has she gone too far? You know, has she gone too
far? Well, she's gone too far for Tyrion and Arya and Jon Snow. And I think that the writers up to including Martin himself are saying, you know, it's fire with fire, terrible, but it's a case of what could she do. They were dug in. Cersei brought the population into the place, she put them in the way, and how else was she gonna do it without a horrible, you know, without a horrible outcome, without basically going you know, going fucking lulah. You can't fight wars without going doolally. And they reinforce the point because the Grey Worm loses it too. He also lost his girl, of course.
Yeah.
And after, you know, they're not interested in a surrender. They just go on going doolally afterwards, you know.
Yeah.
Both him and Danny. And you can argue that's the price, you know.
Mm.
That's the price of ridding yourself of tyranny. Yeah. It's not going to be pretty. I mean, we couldn't, you know, go down into Berlin handing out lollipops and shift Hitler, you know.
Yeah.
The Japanese, you know, there's the argument of Hiroshima is inutterably horrible and the States are the only people who have used a nuclear weapon.
Yeah.
But how many would have died in a land invasion of the Japanese mainland? Because they would have booby-trapped the whole fucking country, you know.
Yeah.
And they would have, and they're happy to admit it and would have been really good at it.
Yeah.
You know? Many fiendish and brilliant and small and mini death traps.
But that's the thing, you know.
I think that's what they're saying.
I think you're right. I think the thing is what they're saying is, guys, this is a war, right?
And,
and in a war, there comes a point where nobody's giving in. And somebody's got to do something massive and horrible.
I think there's an argument that Jon Snow and the other lot, you know, and his crew and up to and including the other Starks, the Tyrion and so on, they're in denial about just how vile and unmoving Cersei was. Mm. You know, I mean, I won't spoil it anymore because there's little details and you'll see them yourselves. But that's the bottom line, I think, is, and I think there's a good chance that in the last episode, she's going to be saying that.
Mm.
She's going to be, and I also think she's going to probably hand it to John.
Yeah.
And bugger off back to Dakari land.
Yeah.
Because she's not loved there and everyone's got it wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that she'll think, well, I've rid them of the tyrant. There's a really nice fellow who I love on the throne. Although, having said that, there's scope for twists there because he don't want it, does he?
No.
So you've got who's the other principal Stark woman? Not the many faced, not Arya.
Sansa.
She could end up on the throne, I think.
Yeah, she could. She could.
You know. But and then John, again, having John said, going ruled in the north. You know.
But then having said that, a case might be made for the fact that the perfect person to have the throne is someone who doesn't want it.
Yeah. You know? Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, I think so, but I do. I just think that I don't know. I think that John will probably go north. I think because it's the scene of his auntie's, you know, rampage.
Yeah.
I don't know. The other thing is he might kill her, of course, as might Arya.
Yeah. Oh,
she might turn up looking like the Grey Worm and in the face of the Grey Worm and do her as well. I don't know if they'll give her two main slayings, though. You know, perhaps that changes the odds. Listen to us. But this is what's happened. I mean, it's the big cultural event, isn't it, of this period. And as I say, they've raised the bar. You can only wonder when anyone will get near again.
Yeah,
it's scope and sweep.
I mean, the Battle of Winterfell, I think, was like one of the best pieces of, like, never mind movies, never mind television, best pieces of filmed entertainment I think I've seen in as long as.
This has been Swashbuckler Epiphany Episode 6, presented by Clark and Bruce. Swashbuckler Epiphany is a Sperm of the Moment production by Veil Brain Lab Studios. Swashbuckler Epiphany will return. Swashbuckler Epiphany.